Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hello and welcome to day five, the final day of the inaugural Hexagon Cup here from the Madrid Arena in the heart of Spain.
Buenos. I'm in Madrid, just leaving the Hotel Ribera del Manzanares and walking along the banks of Madrid's slightly underwhelming central river that flows through the Spanish capital city. I don't know how this podcast is going to work actually, because I haven't got a clue how it's going to work, obviously. So there's no reasons and rationale to that. I just don't know how it's going to work. The vague plan is to hear from Pete at some point, who's still in the Isle of Man, but I think he's heading fairly soon, I think I'm right in saying, off to a Trinity training camp, probably in Spain, although I don't know. And to hear definitely from David, who is, I think, arrived now in Switzerland for the UCI TV commentators course that I should have been attending. And if you heard the last podcast we did, you'll know already the reason why I'm not attending it. So David will be reporting basically from at some point from Switzerland on the various learnings that he has made while he's on that course. And I am here in Madrid to introduce you to the fascinating world of paddle. This is Never Strays Far with Pete Kenyuk, David Miller and Ned Bolton. Right, okay, so that was a good opening. I literally don't know how this is going to work. I'll start by just saying that I learned something quite interesting about Madrid that I never knew, that the Spanish capital city was only a little town of 10,000 inhabitants until the 16th century, I think, when King Philip II declared that Madrid should be the capital of the Spanish kingdom. And shunned the attentions of, or the rival attentions of, other cities, which would have been perhaps more suited and were at the time much more strategically important and had big castles already that would have kind of made them fitting seats for the centre of power in Spain. But for various different political and mostly geographical reasons, they chose to locate the Spanish capital in Madrid, right in the middle of the Iberian Peninsula, to straddle, to look each way, to make it difficult for attacking forces and armies to actually penetrate that deep into the interior, to sack the capital, and to draw the country together in kind of, you know, rather obvious geographical way. But I thought it was rather interesting, and one of the reasons why Madrid is, in that regard, a kind of created capital city, younger in many ways, although it's obviously a long time ago, than most of the other big European capitals. Historically, you think of Rome or even London or Paris. They all have, you know, significant populations that date much, much further back than Madrid. And one of the reasons why Madrid wasn't an obvious choice in some ways is its river that flows through the middle. It's piddling. The Manzanares, which I'm walking alongside now on a Sunday morning with people out on their bikes and strolling along. It's just like a mountain stream that trickles through the middle of Madrid. You couldn't possibly navigate it. No way you could get a ship down there. Sandbanks sort of left, right and centre, and maybe the water's a bit low at the moment, but you could just about, if you were really skillful, I suppose, go to Decathlon and buy a canoe and pass through the centre of Madrid. But every now and again, you would probably bottom out and scrape the bottom of your new Decathlon canoe on a sandbank. Anyway, I am going up. You can probably tell by my voice, actually, you, podcast listeners, are the first people I've spoken to today. It's Sunday, February the something, 4th, And I am about to, I'm walking to work, I'm heading to the Madrid Arena, where I'm going to commentate for the fifth day in succession on this sport that 5 days ago I had never seen with the naked eye, but now I feel thoroughly well versed in. The fastest growing sport in the world, with the silliest name. But don't be fooled by the silly name, because it's a secret delight. And I've been very privileged to be part of the Hexagon Cup paddle broadcast operation for the last 5 days. I have one more day remaining. Just a sense now that Alex Rees is hating his life. Not enjoying it now. Looks downcast, Alex Rees. They trail 5-7 in the super tiebreak, and they started dancing. Is that a bit premature? Celebrations have begun early for the team in white.
I suppose I should explain what paddle is, because I can't assume that people know. Because frankly, a few weeks ago, I sort of knew what it was, just from travelling to Spain and places and seeing these strange courts around in every little town and village. It's because it's all over Spain, where you see these. It's like a squash court, stroke tennis court, kind of hybrid thing, and it's incredibly popular in Spain and in South America, and it's got a really interesting history actually. Kind of, it started in Mexico, and spread from there. And but it, at the moment, it's an incredibly fast growing sport, but it's kind of almost entirely Spanish speaking. So South America, and in particular Argentina and Spain, are sort of where it's at. And it's really taken off in those cultures, in those countries. And some major investors have got hold of it now and kind of want to spread it beyond those territories and across the world. So the weird thing about this tournament, which has been created out of thin air, if you like, by some people who are actually behind the electric Formula One series, Formula E, same people, same investors. They've created this event, they've attracted the best players in the world, and they've created these franchise teams that are going to be involved in this Hexagon Cup, and they've put €1 million of prize money up. And the teams have been created with this investment by Rafa Nadal and Andy Murray, Robert Lewandowski, the Barcelona footballer, and even Desperate Housewives actor Eva Longoria, who I had to Google. And she's been here in Madrid for the last few days, adding a bit of kind of Hollywood stardust. Anyway, the days have come. So I was joking the other day on the podcast about, I think, you know, one of our Q&A sessions with listeners' questions, when someone asked me, what sport do you think would be the easiest to commentate on? And I kind of jokingly said tennis. Well, here I am. Literally, I've been approached to commentate on paddle. It's not as easy as I thought. It's been incredibly difficult. Every single day, the first 3 days, we were on air uninterrupted for 8 hours. Yesterday on Saturday, we came on air at around about 10 o'clock in the morning in Madrid and didn't come off air until 10 o'clock at night, nearly 11. So like 13 hours. I honestly thought commentating on Milan-San Remo or an entire stage of the Giro d'Italia was long. Because it was long, like 6 hours, 6.5 hours is quite a long time to commentate on a bike race, but it's half what I've been doing here in paddle at the Madrid Arena. It's unbelievable. Also learning a completely new way of commentating, totally different rhythm and everything like that. But I have to say, it's been absolutely brilliant fun. And today we've got like three different finals in three different categories, and it comes to an end.
Well, I am not in Madrid. I am in Aigle at the Centre Mondial du Cyclisme, UCI headquarters. I thought I was going to be here with Ned, but I found out on last week's pod that Ned's not coming, because after his little paddle extravaganza, he is now on a Napoleonic tour of Paris with one of his old friends. So I'm here solo, representing Britain's national broadcaster, ITV, as their commentator, their only commentator. And so that's nice. But yeah, I'm here for the UCI seminar for TV commentators. Give you a little rundown of what this afternoon involves. I got a welcome lunch, which I'm just about to walk into. I have no idea who else is here, so that'll be interesting. Then we have an introduction and welcome speech from Peter Van Den Abuel, UCI Sports Director. Never heard of him till now, so it's probably useful to know. Then we have What's New in Professional Road Cycling from Laurent Bezot, the UCI Road Manager, organisers and calendar, and Julien Chauvelon, UCI Road Manager, riders and teams. Then we have the Extreme Weather Protocol with Dr. Xavier Bigard and Laurent Bezol as UCI Medical Doctor and UCI Road Manager. Now, actually, I think that was the last time I was here because I was the rider representative for when the UCI Extreme Weather Protocol was being created. Seems like a lifetime ago. Then we've got medical update and concussion. Then some safer, improving the safety of road cycling and innovation with Mick Rogers, former pro cyclist, who's now the UCI Head of Innovation and Cycling Esport, and Laurent Bezol, UCI Road Manager. Then a Q&A open discussion, which Ned guided me last week to refer to horse racing regards how we deal with controversies at the finish line. I'll see if I bring that up or not. I probably will. And apart from that, I'll see who I can catch here to have a little chat. This is actually a very good initiative from UCI because I think the main reason is to stop us from basically just making stuff up on air about what the UCI are doing and generally slagging them off, which we really shouldn't do. So hopefully, after today and tomorrow's seminar, I will be able to inform our viewers exactly of what the UCI are doing behind the scenes to improve professional road racing. Right, I'm off.
Have you ever heard of a famous podcast called Never Strays Far with Pete Kenyuk, David Miller and Ned Bolting?
No, I haven't yet, but I did right now.
Fantastic. Mauri Andrini is my my co-commentator for the first 4 days and into the fifth day at the Hexagon Cup. Mauri is from Argentina, which you'd never guess because he's like quite shy.
He's a quiet
guy, doesn't talk very much. He's a bit pasty. He doesn't have a kind of olive complexion. He doesn't look naturally fit. He hasn't got great teeth. He's just a classic Argentinian man, really, aren't you?
Man, how are you doing? Thank you. Thank you for joining me into your fantastic podcast.
I should say, so Mauri's been, honestly, I couldn't have done this job. I could literally not have done this job without Mauri holding my hand alongside me. Mauri used to play paddle. At a high level, world junior champion, Mauri.
Yes, I was. Well, long ago, around 25 years ago.
Doesn't matter. World champion.
2000, yeah.
World champion. Under
18, yeah. Beating some of the guys we are watching right now.
And then what went wrong?
Well, but actually, you know, wines and that stuff. You know, I'm not that good at being very, very professional. I like other stuff in life. So, yeah.
But then he went on to become a coach, top coach. What's your coaching company called?
The coach. Hello Paddle Academy.
Hello Paddle Academy.
It's the only two things I knew how to say when I arrived to the UK.
Hello.
Hello, I'm to play paddle, and that's it. You know, that's how I started. And and then was people talking. Oh my, how are you doing, buddy? My name is Pia. Pia, what do you mean? Well, yeah, it was a little bit hard in the beginning, but then I got used to it. And yeah, after 5 years living in the UK, gave me a massive opportunity to work worldwide, to learn some English. And even though my English is not perfect,
that's but very least, good, Mauri.
Yeah, it's better than your Spanish, perhaps.
Yeah,
and,
maybe.
At some point, paddle has been growing massively worldwide. And that's giving me the chance to live for what I love to do, you know. And you could tell after 12 hours non-stop talking about paddle in this event.
Now, was that the moment? Was that the moment?
I can't no breathe.
Could be.
I can't no breathe anymore.
Yeah. Alex Rees, a lack of composure there, and he knows it.
Never giving up in paddle.
He's susceptible to those moments, and that's the difference between him and the other.
No, it does his leg. And
great honesty.
Quadruple match point to the ones that you've never expected, perhaps, in the second set that they will win the match. Have a look where they are. This is Dineno and Juan Tello ready to win their Hexagon Cup 2024.
Saturday, we did 13 hours of commentating. 13 hours.
Yeah, but the thing is that we was not only 13 hours, it was that non-stop 13
non-stop,
hours.
Non-stop, except to go to the lunch. Toilet. Except to go to the toilet.
Yeah, but how long did it take to go to the toilet? What, 1.5 minutes?
Yeah, no, 2 minutes, 15 seconds, I've timed it.
Because we have to run down the stairs at the back of here and then down another two flights of stairs to the toilet.
In the dark, very dark, danger stairs, yeah, actually.
And my voice is, you can tell, my voice is so broken that I'm drinking lots of water to keep my voice working. So as a consequence, I had to go to the toilet four times yesterday.
Yeah, it's crazy. But Ned, I got to tell you, man, and I'm, thanks that you said that, you know, that you like to be doing the commentary with me and so on. But
brilliant fun.
For me, I what I said just today, before we arrived here to the production of this fantastic event, I said, man, listen, if I don't know how you do such a professional commentary. Yeah, man, it's impossible. I just do my job, you know. I know about paddle.
Yeah,
I'm a paddle coach, and I speak some English. That's it. And I said to you, man, even though if I'm not here, I would be watching home 13 hours. You wouldn't. So that's why for you, I would say that it's harder because, you know, you come from other sports, but that shows that you are very professional in what you do.
When we came off air yesterday, this is what you said to me. You said, well done, I can't believe you managed to watch paddle for 13 hours.
Yeah, yeah.
You said, I would love to watch paddle for 13 hours because you love it. And then you said to me, it's like me watching
and commentating
like 13 hours of cycling.
It's going to be just impossible. that's what I mean. You know, you might be talking about things that I have no clue about. And yeah, now you're talking about Bandeja, Víbora, Lobs, Juan Martín Díaz. What the hell is that?
Bandejas.
20 years ago.
Por tres, por cuatro.
Your Spanish, man, is becoming like massive.
I love bandeja. So explain what a bandeja is.
Well, bandeja is a very unique paddle shot, I would say. There's kind of a smash, but combined with a volley, let's say. It's not a powerful smash. It's a placement smash. Placed smash, exactly. That.
Vivero.
Víbora. Víbora is a rattle snake. The translation is rattle snake. It's a kind of a shot that you play with side spin, with a lot of spin that the
flat ball over the net.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
Vicious. No, it's been brilliant, Maori. It's been absolutely amazing. I'm going to describe to the rest of our podcast audience exactly how they play paddle. But honestly, are we going to come back and do this again? Do you think?
Yeah, hopefully. I think this event came to work to the world of paddle just to stay for longer. You know, they've done a great job. They are investing a lot of money because they know that the growth of paddle is there,
yeah,
for the next 5 years at least. And big names are behind this event. So, and I think they are thinking to make like this and bigger.
I should say, by the way, you were also the Great Britain coach for how many years?
Yeah, 7 years.
Seven years.
I was coaching the national team. Yeah, well, paddle in the UK is not that big yet.
It's tiny.
But yeah, it's tiny, but it's starting, you know, and it's starting. I'm still in contact with all of the players. I left the team just because Hello Paddle was growing. And naturally, I got to look after my academy, my family, my staff, you know, because being a coach of a national team is not an easy task to do. So I prefer just to look after my family and my academy, rather to be coaching the national team, that it could be coached by a British guy, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Who's your favorite Argentinian professional cyclist?
Cyclist?
Who's your favorite?
Lionel Messi.
Ah, that's pathetic. And he had a great opportunity to say Max Riquese, the lead out man for Mark Cavendish at Etics Quick Step, you remember?
Not really. I'm not for that gourmet, sorry.
Honestly.
Which is your favorite paddle player?
Juan Martín Díaz.
Exactly. You see, man, we are very similar in one part of the sports. Yeah, very good. Thank you.
No, come on. This is going to be agony.
One of them is saved. One of them is saved. Three match points remain. Because why not? Because make it that bit more tense.
Wow.
No.
Stupachuk
refuses to lie down. But there it comes. It's all over. The match is won. Team Advantage have closed it out again. They are the natural born winners in the Hexagon Cup. They know how to get over the line here in Madrid like no other team. And Dinero has taken it.
Ooh. It's about 10 o'clock at night in Madrid after day 5 of the paddle, the Hexagon Cup, and I'm leaving, I'm walking away from the Madrid Arena. Now, in the reverse direction from the earlier little audio clip that you heard in this excellently produced feature, which you are now listening to for reasons that probably only you can explain to yourself, if only you knew why. I've completed my duties as the Hexagon Cup's World Feed commentator on paddle. And I have to say, kind of loved it as well. It was crazy long hours. I mean, crazy long hours. Literally, I could have done on the Saturday, I could have commentated Milan San Remo in its entirety twice. Milan San Remo, Milan, like Paris-Brest-Paris. They could have got to the Poggio, dropped down into the Via Roma, done a circuit, I can imagine the circuit, through the finishing line, turn left down that square, past the palm trees and the Zone Technique, back along the waterfront, and then along to the roundabout with the big San Remo sort of concrete, statue that says San Remo on it, and then gone back along past the Nobel House and with the Poggio on the left, and then gone along the race route in reverse and ridden all the way back to a finish in Milan. All that would have been possibly even slightly quicker to do than my Saturday adventure in paddle. It's a good game. So I've got to convince Pete and David somehow that I wonder where we're going to find a paddle court this summer in France that we should play paddle, although I'm a bit intimidated by how good I can absolutely guess that Pete and David will be, because it's like wall ball but with a net and with a bat, and they're quite good at that. They're slightly better than me. I'm not terrible at it, but they're slightly better than me. And the last time I played it, I was 2 years younger as well. Oh no, I was 2 years. Yeah, last time. Yeah, 2 years younger. I'm 2 years older now. I'm older than I once was, and younger than I'll be. That's not unusual. I'm older than I once was, and younger than I've been, that's not unusual. Lord, is it strange? Yeah, that's the end of my paddle journey. For now, but we'll see where it goes from here, and who knows? Who knows, one day I may be writing how I won the paddle bat.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
So fortunately, I've walked in here and there's only a couple of faces. Well, maybe three or four faces I recognise, or at least know the names too. And one of them is Daniel Lloyd, aka Lloydie, former, same as a shared teammate, same old Garmin days. And the man behind much loved GCN. Lloydie, how is it?
It's all good. I'm not the man behind much of GCN. No. I've been there from the start, but yeah.
For the racing side of like organising.
Yes, when we had racing, obviously it's gone. GCN Plus is no longer, but yeah, all good. It's a long time ago we were teammates now, isn't it? Is it 13 years?
Yeah, a lifetime ago. So tell us, because I remember when it all came to light in November, December, all of us were devastated to see the demise of GCN as we know it. And I think it's all the more apparent now the season starts, and it's gone back to medieval times of trying to find a bike race. What's the journey been like the past kind of 8 years building that and then having to kind of reset? And tell us about what's going on, that journey through from retiring to now. Obviously, we could be here for 2 hours talking about that, but, you know, the kind of the cliff notes.
Well, starting with GCN Plus, I mean, obviously everybody within the company was hugely surprised to start with and then massively disappointed. I understand the decision, and I think we made this clear at the time that, you know, it can be confusing, or it could be confusing, when commentators have to mention Discovery Plus, Eurosport, GCN Plus. Doesn't really make a lot of sense. So I think what Warner Brothers Discovery wanted to do is narrow down how many apps there are to watch it, and they'll be launching on Max in the US their cycling soon. I think they've got something in the pipeline for Australia and New Zealand as well, which is currently, you know, really struggling to find where the racing is. So it will still be the same coverage, you know, the same commentators, the same people you see on the breakaway. In the UK, it's pretty easy. In most of Europe, it's on Discovery Plus. But yeah, it was a fantastic 3 years or so that we had that app. I really enjoyed it. Yeah, I've spent a long time in the media since we finished racing. But I absolutely love doing the live races. I'm sure you do as well. Just watching it, you know, when you're privileged enough to have it as a job, and watch a 3 week grand tour unfold in front of you and watch every single minute of it. You know, when you've got that privilege of having the time to put into it and watch it, it's like no other sport. Not that I've watched all other sports, but.
Yeah, I mean, incredible. I felt the same thing. Cause I mean, it was, I don't think I'd have watched bike racing if I would have done eventually, but coming straight out and going straight into commentary, it was the first time I'd actually watched bike racing since I was a kid. Cause when you're a pro, you don't watch it, you're in it. And you don't, it's obviously can't watch it live. You're not going to watch the highlights in the evening. And so when I got to watch it, I was like, oh my God, I love this so much. And it was the, and I think that's what's interesting when you get the former pros like you come into the sport to watch it. We see it with fresh eyes because you've been seeing it like first person in there.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, when you kind of get that helicopter shot and the motorbikes and we know all the stories and the different narratives, you, it's like this jigsaw coming together that you never saw before. Is that what it was like for you?
Almost exactly the same, yeah. I mean, I wouldn't say I struggled at the start, but I probably lacked confidence to a degree because I was sort of acutely aware I hadn't been one of the top pros. And so when you're commentating, I was half thinking about whether it wouldn't be right to be critical of somebody that was basically better than I was on the bike. It just felt a bit weird. But then you realise, you know, that all these riders have got coaches who aren't as good as they are on the bike. So there are still people who have an insight and an opinion on stuff that can give that. But I think it's interesting as the co-commentator because you have to sort of evolve. Because like I said, initially, you've got a load of stories that, you know, pop into your mind as things happen on the TV. And they're interesting to the viewer and the listener because they'd never heard them before. But there obviously comes a point where you've kind of got to the end of most of your anecdotes, unless you're Jens Vogt, who seems to come up with them decade after decade. And so you have to transition into sort of something else where you're deep diving into the tactics a bit more, rather than just relying on your stories. And as you would have found out, it's really important to watch as much racing as you can every year, because initially it's so easy because you know 90% of the peloton. There's, you know, 10% neo pros that you're not really aware of but you learn about. But within 5 years, it's just an unrecognizable place. So if you haven't watched some of the smaller races and these amazing kids coming up through the ranks, you can get a bit lost, I think.
Oh, completely. I mean, I was following the results this year and it's just newer humans every year. Yeah. It's just wild. That's one of the things I think, I mean, you're being pretty humble. There's very few former pros. We go into the co-commentary position, which is the colour in the kind of the pro thing. But you also do lead commentary, which is, I'd be curious to know when you started doing that and how you have to shift between lead and colour.
About probably 3 or 4 years ago, I think I did it for the first time. And it is a difficult transition because I think Matt Stevens finds the same because he flips between the two as well. I think you're so, you want the audience to not think that you're thick. And so you can end up answering your own question,
right,
if you know what I mean. Like, do you think it's A, B or C? Probably C, isn't it? And it leaves the co-commentator with nowhere to go. Like, well, yeah, I agree with you, Dan. You know, that is what it is. So you just have to sort of take the ego out of it and ask a question that you know the answer to, but to get the expert opinion alongside you. I mean, I don't do loads of it. And generally when I do, it's just to give the lead commentator a break in the middle of the Grand Tours because, you know, since they've been live from flag drop to finish line, it's a long old stint to carry it all the way through on your own. So I just do that central bit where often not much is happening. I think it just takes a lot more. It takes a lot more research to have stuff down that you know you're going to talk about if there's absolutely nothing happening. You know, whether it's the local area, general cycling news, the risk is that you are so determined to get through those notes that you've made that you then drift off and miss something that's happening on the screen. You know, people get very frustrated when that happens and they're like screaming at you, like something's going on, you're not even looking at it. But it's, you know, it's a difficult job, as you know, and you can never please everybody. Everyone's got their favourite commentators and those they don't like so much. But the advantage with cycling is there's so much of it that you can kind of spread the commentators out and you're always going to come across one that you really enjoy listening to.
Yeah, pick and choose. So back to real life stuff, the kind of former pro meeting whenever we meet each other is like, what are you up to? And kind of, you're doing sport, you're riding. And it's interesting, you're what, a decade out now? More? No, just 12 years. 12 years, just over. And so I think we're hitting that same point, because I'm, 10 years this year, where you were talking before about how up to now you've always needed objectives. Mm. And you kind of, without the objective, you can't do it, which is very much a kind of a pro athlete mentality. And yeah. Tell us about the switch you've had, because it sounds like exactly what I'm going through at the moment.
I love work. Like, those are the goals that I have in my head these days, you know, apart from family. But I sort of live life to the full on the grand tours, let's put it that way. You know, I the nice thing about what we do is that you get along with the people that you work with. And so we just really enjoy each other's company, you know, for dinners in the evening. And dinner turns into another drink and another drink and another drink. And so I didn't really feel bad, but I got to the end of the Tour de France last year and I was just thinking, well, I'm not really exercising, not really living a particularly healthy lifestyle. Like, diet's always been fine for me. I've never struggled with that. We always have home-cooked meals at home. I eat well, but it was just the other things, like a lack of exercise. Sleep was no good, partly due to the alcohol. Because I'd probably have sort of 6, 7, 8 beers every night. And then, I wouldn't say wing it the next day. I was sort of quite lucky that, I think probably like you, I don't really get hangovers the next day. So you can get through it and feel like you've done absolutely fine. So yeah, I started to sort of think to myself, well, you know, I might not have any goals of a gravel race, or, you know, I've done challenges of GCN, like how fit can I get in 10 weeks, that kind of thing. And that is kind of what floats my boat. Like, I like that, you know, as soon as I've got a goal in front of me, I find it easy to tick off the bits.
Especially when it's a social contract like that, and it's a challenge.
Well, exactly, yeah. You've made a statement to yourself and to sometimes members of the public, and so you've got to stick with it. It was the same when we were racing, you know, you had a goal and it was quite easy, not all the time, but you could work towards that. But I've now realised, through listening to a lot of podcasts actually and reading quite a lot, about what you need to do at our kind of age to ensure that when you get to hopefully 80, 90, that you're still mobile and you can still live an active life, you know, and that work starts now. So I think I've got my head around, you know, the goal is not 10 weeks down the line now. The goal is whenever this life finishes, and I'm going to do my utmost to build up muscle, be flexible, get a higher VO2 max again, which for the last 10 years has just seemed pointless. But I've done that bit. Why would I need to worry about going to a laboratory and seeing what the VO2 max is? You know, those tests are horrible. But I'm now thinking in a very different way. How's it been with you?
Same thing. I mean, I fell in love with my bike again last year. And it was the same. I got to that sort of tipping point of unhealth. And, you know, it was, as you said, in my up to mid-40s, was pretty bomb-proof up to a degree. And then started to notice my mental health being down, my physical. I was at kind of bottom, most unfit, most unhealthy I've ever been under 2022, and was just unhappy with it all. And so had this kind of big reset, and this past year I've realized that sport's an integral part of my life. You know, and I think it took 9 years, I think the 18 years of being a professional cyclist, I'd forgotten why I got into sport in the first place, and why I'd loved cycling, why I'd loved skating and tennis and all these different things. Sport was an integral part of my life. And then when it became a professional part of my life, I loved it for the majority of my career, but towards the end, and I think that's the reason we all stopped, we're burnt out mentally more than physically. So when I got to the end, although my body was still prime, my head had fallen off, and I didn't want to ride my bike and I didn't want to do sport. Like you said, I didn't want to suffer. I didn't want to go through all that. And so sport became something that I didn't want to do. And without it, I kind of realized over time and recently that without it, my head's just not right, let alone my body. Mm. And getting back into sport again this past year, and without setting goals, without setting the kind of a goal that is quantifiable or has to have a result, a target that I'm aiming for, it's just going and doing it for the enjoyment, which I'd completely forgotten about. And so for me this past year, sport's become a daily thing, and it's kind of running or going to the gym or riding my bike, mountain biking, road, gravel. And it's like being a teenager again. It's kind of, it's given me that outlet. It's given me that, and I don't think I've been this healthy since my 20s, kind of just feeling so good in my body, and it's made everything better. And it's exactly like you said, and it's, I think more for me, it was mental health. That kind of was the primary objective. Yeah. And I was oblivious, or I was completely blinkered to actually the huge missing link in my life was exercise.
Yeah.
Because I think for many of us, and this is something I've thought about a lot, is a lot of professional cyclists, To become a professional cyclist, it's quite an odd sport to choose because it's not a kind of social, it's not got any social status in it. You've not, it's not teams at school, it's not local clubs. It's, you do it because you're a bit of a loner and you probably do it because it's good for your head. You like going out on your own and you like going on these adventures. And then when you get into the professional sport, that kind of gets taken away. All of a sudden you're in a social environment. There's everything quantifiable. There's success or failure. And over time you forget why you got into it in the first place. And so for me, that renaissance this past year has been the most wonderful thing, yeah. To kind of realize that I am a cyclist, I am an athlete, I just love doing it.
I remember a quote from you, and I've nicked it for myself over the last 10 years. I think it was you. It was something along the lines of, you know, if you're an ex-golfer, darts player or snooker player, you can, you know, hang your queue up for 5 years. And as soon as you pick it up again, you're better than someone that started 5 years ago and has played it every day. Whereas you can hang your bike up for 2 years and somebody that's been training their ass off for the last 2 years just kicks your ass. Yeah. You know, so that's another reason why I was like, I don't know if I need to do this really. Like, I used to be a lot better than this. I don't need to have my ass handed to me by somebody that's just picked the sport up.
It's so true. And I think that, yeah, that was me that said that, because it was that thing I'd see ex-footballers, ex-tennis players, racing drivers, they would have masters events or exhibition things. And even if they weren't the best, they'd get glimpses of their genius themselves, you know, and we never get a glimpse of our genius ever again once you retire from being a pro cyclist. And it takes quite a while to come to terms with that and let it go.
Yeah.
And so for me, it's taken a decade to let that go, to turn up to events like I did last year, like the Tracker or Cape Epic, and just line up and think, I don't care what people think, what I'm going to do today, I'm just going to go and do it. I'll start at the back. And that's been a huge paradigm shift.
I had a similar thing with numbers. I mean, as you probably remember, I was just sort of so... I like numbers. I like numbers. I like the data. And I enjoyed that when I was training. But I found that hard, so hard to give up. So, during these sporadic moments where I'd be back on the bike for a couple of months, you know, there was one time in 2014 where we moved house. And there's this, like, family single-track trail near us that I was taking the boys around. And about 2 weeks in, I was like, I wonder what the fastest time around this track is. And I became obsessed for, I don't know, it was probably 3-4 months it took me to, I bought a new bike. I was, like, doing intervals out training. And I eventually beat this record. The person who I beat then smashed me. I did it again. And he didn't seem to be able to beat it. And so I just stopped riding again. And in subsequent times, I might get back into the bike. And it's normally not long before I'm like... Well, there's a tailwind up here. I wonder what the Strava time is up here. And I'll just, you know, I'll nail it as quick as I can. But again, I've just now got to the point where it's like, I don't need to do that. I don't need to prove to myself or to anybody else anymore that I'm all right on a bike.
Also, and this is something you'll now notice and what I realise, is up to a couple of years ago, you could still go pretty hard. But my VO2 max now is actually naturally dropping quite significantly. Mm. And so when I was younger, I had that natural, just innate ability to go deep whenever I wanted and pull out crazy stuff. And that's gone. So now that's gone, you're like, okay, I have a physical reason where I can't do that stuff. Yeah. It's almost like I've given myself a kind of get out of jail free card.
Well, you'll be able to tell that I've been thinking about life longevity a lot recently, because the most recent GSIN show, depending on when this comes out, was about like the 6 key signs of living a long life and how they relate to cycling, you know, which ones you can get from cycling. And whilst I was researching that, I found out your VO2 max generally drops by 4 points every 10 years from the age of 30, I think it is. So, you know, if you start from where most people would be, I guess 50, 40, you know, 4 points every 10 years, it drops, it's a huge drop. So if you can get it up towards, you know, 60, I've got no idea where mine would be at the moment. I actually looked up my previous VO2 max test, which was 2010 or something, 2011. And it was 74. And I remember at the time thinking, I'm quite disappointed, because you hear about the Le Mans of this world. It's like, well, I should be 90 plus, like, you know, almost beating the record. But in hindsight, I look at that and think, well, yeah, I expect it's dropped a lot since then. So I need to try and get it back up before time and life takes its toll. How long after you started riding again did your mental health improve?
I'd say... Probably within a couple of months. I mean, I think once I got into the routine of it and once I kind of let go, all of a sudden I was enjoying it again.
Yeah.
Which was the biggest thing before I get on and I got my road bike, and I still live in the same place from when I was pro, and it was like ghosts of me past everywhere on the roads. And then I started to go out and just enjoy it for the sake of it and ride for the sake of it and not... And I still I still love all the data like you. I mean, that never goes away. But now it's... I don't base it off the past. It's more just a kind of curiosity.
Yeah.
And so I think it... And it wasn't just the bike, it was running. It was because, like you, when we're traveling, it's a nightmare. So I kind of started running again, and I was like, oh, I love this. And that's interesting because that's almost a completely blank slate. So there are no ghost paths for that. Mm. So that's like being a beginner. There's a beginner mindset.
Yeah.
Going in, and it's like mastering something. And that goes back to my teenage years. One of the reasons I love starting all these different sports, I love that journey of mastery, of kind of learning something new and going out. And so that's something I've realized is really important for me as well, is finding things that I'm starting anew and kind of taking the mastery journey, even though it's not going to lead to mastery. It's just that kind of that journey of curiosity and listening to running podcasts and reading up on it or gym stuff. And it's like the whole longevity thing, like you're talking about. It's, I think when people hear or see the longevity thing, they think, oh, you're trying to live forever. It's not that. It's just, how do I kind of, am I healthy for as long as possible? How can I enjoy the length of my life? And very much, I think, as well, with all the mental health talk these days, we so underestimate kind of how much we need to engage our body for our head to work, because that's what we're designed to do. Yeah. And so that's been such a massive, and it sounds ridiculous, having been a professional athlete for 18 years and lived off my body, if you like, to be 47, 46, 47, and to kind of suddenly discover, oh, this is what I need to do to live the good life.
I think that happens to people in all worlds, doesn't it? You know, get people working in the city somewhere and just tunnel visioned on the objectives they have from a work point of view, and all of a sudden, you know, if you look at the average life expectancy, you've lived more than you've got to go. And so that's why you've probably got loads of mammals out there, you know, middle-aged men in Lycra.
And I respect them massively now.
Well, exactly.
Yeah. Well, thanks.
It's quite interesting. I find it really interesting looking at the difference between ex-pros when they finish, because you get some like us that maybe turn away from the bike for a bit, and then you get others that just, even though they're not doing it professionally anymore, they just love it still. You know, Jens is here and he just loves riding his bike still. You know, Matt Stevens loves smashing himself.
But isn't there a direct correlation in their mental health?
Well, yeah, that's a very good point.
You know, it's all those guys we see and we kind of, at first, we kind of take the piss out of them. Oh my God, why are they still riding?
Yeah.
And 5 years later, you're like in a hole and they're just still doing the same thing, except they perhaps didn't burn themselves out as much, or it didn't go straight into something. But I now have a lot of, I realise, and this is an interesting point. When I, in the 1990s, when I turned pro, they used to say, oh, when you stop, you're going to need a couple of years of keeping riding your bike.
I remember Sean Kelly saying that.
And so what I thought at the time, they were talking about the physical things. Actually, it was about your mental health. Just keep riding your bike, because you need to kind of slowly almost wean your brain off the endorphins, off all the neurochemistry that had gone on, linked so strongly to those years of just peeking your body out. Whereas if you go cold turkey at it, you will sadly probably go down other routes of addiction or drug abuse, alcohol abuse. And yet if you keep riding your bike, it's almost as if you're self-medicating. And I had not, it's only now I realize that that was the old kind of way of doing it, was you were supposed to wean yourself off the exercise.
Yeah, that's interesting. I guess Sean Yates was one of the most extreme examples.
Maybe extreme being the key word,
Not only did he not stop riding his bike when he finished as a pro rider, he started by kicking the asses of anyone that was in the team that he was running or managing. And even when doctors said, look, it's probably a good idea for you to not push yourself this hard anymore, he just couldn't, you know, he was literally addicted to riding a bike. So, yeah, it's fascinating watching what ex-athletes do post-retirement and how much they still do it.
So when's the longevity thing coming out, do you know?
So we did a GCN show on it, which came out last Tuesday, which would have been, well, yesterday, 6th of February. But I'm hoping to do like a series of videos where I sort of look at where I'm at right now with blood markers and VO2 max and strength tests, and make sort of certain, not like drastic changes, but try and make changes in my life that are going to impact that, so that hopefully in 6 months or a year time, when I go back and do the same tests again, there are indications that it's doing the right thing. Because I sort of, you know, there'll be people that watch that and there'll be people that are listening to this who are older than us thinking, what are they talking about? You know, they're young still. There'll be other people listening to this who
we are old too. You know, we're veteran status in cycling. I always remember training with veterans when I was 19, thinking, gosh, they're old. But hopefully there'll be something in there for everyone of like, you know, you can make these changes to your diet and the type of things that you're eating, or you can add this strength training to your cycling, and it's going to have quite a big impact fairly quickly. So hopefully that'll happen.
Brilliant. Thanks, Dan.
Still to come in part two of Here, There and the Isle of Man, Pete Kenyuk reports from his attempts to run 5 kilometres very fast, David Miller ends up in a white van in Switzerland and has a chat with Jens Vogt, and Ned wanders idly around Paris looking for loose cycling connections in the company of an ex-goalkeeper, ex-rockstar and a man who never changes his t-shirt.
You literally only wear Jimi Hendrix t-shirts.
Yeah, that's true, yeah. Yeah. I do only wear Jimi Hendrix t-shirts.
Although, today you're wearing
a Jimi Hendrix t-shirt.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.